I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is with business columnist Joe Nocera about CEO compensation packages. Why are failed CEOs making millions? But first, let's get an update on the scandal involving a French relief organization accused of attempting to smuggle children from Chad to Europe. Chad borders Sudan. Thousands of refugees from Darfur live on that border. The aid group Zoe's Ark pledged to save Darfur's children, and French families reportedly paid up to $4,500 to host each child saved. But the government of Chad arrested several members of the non-governmental French organization as they were boarding 103 children onto a chartered Spanish plane. Chad's president called the action pure and simple abduction. The French government has distanced itself from Zoe's Ark, and other NGOs in the region are concerned that the incident will tarnish their operations. Well, Newsweek correspondent Christopher Dickey is following the story. He joins us from Paris. Christopher, tell us about Zoe's Ark. They are considered a legitimate aid group, aren't they?
They are, but they're a fairly recently formed group. They got involved with humanitarian action after the tsunami in Asia. And starting in April, along with the French equivalent of Save Darfur, they started organizing this attempted evacuation of what they hoped would be about 10,000 children from Darfur refugee camps. But it's all come a cropper in the last few days.
Well, yes, the organization was founded by a firefighter. The French government flew members of Zoe's Ark on army planes to the Chad area where they set up camp. They hired middlemen, we understand, to find them Darfur orphans.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is that they were really sloppy about the way they chose the children. They started out by telling the sponsors they were going to be getting children who were under five. And if you go to their website in French, you'll see it's all about tens of thousands of children are going to die within the next year. Let's get them out. Let's save those we can. So it really played on the emotions. But when it actually came to working on the ground, they don't seem to have had a very good idea what they were doing. And these middlemen, it appears, were bringing them any children that they could grab.
We understand that some of the middlemen did not even go into neighboring Sudan or into the Darfur refugee camps, but might have gone into neighborhoods in Chad.
That may have been the case. All of this is a little bit murky. What is clear is that the Chadian government is saying many of these children are not orphans. Some of them say they were essentially kidnapped. Others say that they were lured by the middlemen with promises of sweets and other enticements, and then wound up all of a sudden being loaded onto a plane. The president of Chad was making these allegations about the possibility that these children would be used for sex trafficking or for as human organ donors. Mm-hmm. This is, as far as I can tell, pure fabrication, simply something to get people whipped up in Chad. But that it will work in that respect. There's a whole subtext here about anti-colonialism, this idea that the white fathers are not going to come down and tell Chadians what to do, nor are they going to rescue little black children to go live in the safety of white Europe. That's sort of the tone that the Chadian government has taken, and it's created a real diplomatic problem for France.
Especially since French troops, peacekeepers, are expected to come to the area next month, and Chad is a former French colony.
Well, that's right, and the relationships between Chad and its former French masters are always very complicated, and I think this is partly being exploited by the Chadian government as a political maneuver to keep the French government reined in and on the defensive as it gets ready to deploy as part of the peacekeeping forces.
And Christopher, as to Zoe's Ark, do you think that this was just a sincere intention gone wrong or something worse? Because we do read reports that many of the children were swathed with gauze to give the appearance that they were injured when they weren't.
I haven't seen anything that really indicates that they were a malevolent group. They seem to have wanted to do good, but once they were down there operating on the ground, they may have found it was a lot harder to do good than they expected, and they had made a lot of promises to people in France to get these children out. So I suspect they started to stretch the truth, both visually and in terms of what people were being told.
Right. They've been criticized for taking money up front from families. So what happens now? We understand that several of those who've been detained and charged could face, 5 years of hard labor if convicted.
And that would be very hard labor indeed in a Chadian prison. I am sure that the French are going to try and operate quietly to get the sentences reduced or create a situation where the trials, if trials there are held in France. But right now, the Chadian prosecutors are hanging tough and saying, we're going to charge everybody, including a couple of journalists who were along for the ride.
Newsweek correspondent Christopher Dickey. Chris, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Merrill Lynch has announced that ousted CEO Stan O'Neill will not get a severance package. He's not exactly walking away empty-handed. He will get retirement and stock benefits worth about $160 million. Merrill Lynch will also provide him with a New York office, an assistant for up to 3 years, and will pay for the legal fees he racked up negotiating his exit. All that, even though this quarter, under O'Neill's direction, Merrill Lynch lost $2.2 billion, the biggest loss in the company's history. According to the Economic Policy Institute, CEOs make about 262 times the salary of an average worker. Other estimates range up to 400 times, with the average CEO pay coming in at $11 million a year. But why do they make so much when they fail? Joining us for a conversation about CEO compensation packages is New York Times business columnist Joe Nocera. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And first of all, just where do you stand on the big CEO pay thing?
Well, it is more complicated than it tends to get portrayed. Let me say that. But generally, you know, I do think they're excessive. And my main complaint really is that unlike virtually any other salary negotiation in American life, they're not the result of a true arm's-length negotiation. It's a rigged game.
You say it's rigged, it's corrosive. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, how it started. Harvard Business School professor Michael Jensen was one of the architects of these giant compensation packages for executives some 20 years ago. Just remind us what the thinking was, what these huge pay packages were supposed to do.
I remember, if you can indulge me for a minute, you know, I remember in the early 80s, what Michael Jensen really did was create the intellectual foundation for giving out stock options, okay? But then, if you didn't have the corporate raiders of the 1980s, you wouldn't have had people in a position to, in effect, kind of push that in a real-world sense. So what was really happening here was that for many years, corporate executives did not get stock options, and the raiders were complaining, with some justification, that company executives didn't have enough skin in the game, and so they didn't have much of an incentive to care whether the stock price went up or not.
The word that we hear is ossified, that, you know, CEOs were sort of just sitting back in big leather chairs because there wasn't as much as at stake for them.
There's some truth to that, and a lot of being a CEO in those days was not creating shareholder value, but building empires. And so, you know, they would live the good life, but it was basically paid for by the shareholders. They got salaries. Those were the days of corporate hunting lodges, and, you know, you'd build conglomerates just because you felt like it, and it didn't necessarily make any sense for the company or not. And like so much in American life, especially in American financial life, stock options began as a pretty good idea. You know, let's give the CEO and the top management some incentive to get the stock price up, and that will help not only them, but the shareholders as well.
Because the thinking was that they would then take risks. They would use innovative marketing. They would outsource. They would, you know, lay off, you know, and the thinking was they would lay off the fat of a company. They would streamline a company to make it perform
right,
better because they had a stake in it. And remind us what that stake was. Remind us how the stock options worked for them.
Well, the stock options worked for them the way they were for any employees, which is that, let's say the stock is at $10. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you'd give the CEO, let's say, 100,000 shares. His strike price would be $10. So if the stock went down, they were worthless. He didn't lose any money, unlike the shareholders, but they were worthless.
Mm-hmm.
If the stock went up, say it went up to 20, then he would make the difference between the $10 that he got them for and the $20 that it rose. So he'd make $10 a share. That's how stock options work.
Well, then, so what happened here? Michael Jensen, again, one of the architects of these, you know, pay-for-performance compensation packages, told the New York Times recently in an interview that he's working on a new book to, as the Times wrote, fix the flaws that have allowed even failed CEOs to get huge payments. He says mistakes were made, and he seemed to be blaming the compensation boards, the ones who come up with the packages, saying, you know, that they're the ones who signed these contracts that allowed CEOs to be fired for unsatisfactory work but still get the compensation package. What were the mistakes in your view?
Well, mistakes were made. It was flawed from the beginning, really. I mean, there's a couple of things that happened. I don't know if you remember this, but in an effort to rein in CEO pay, the Clinton administration pushed through a bill, for instance, that capped tax deductibility for CEOs at $1 million. So all of a sudden, there's no incentive to give anybody cash salary, and there's huge incentive to give everybody more and more options. That wound up enriching tons of CEOs. Then the second thing that happened was that the SEC mandated that there had to be certain disclosure rules about CEO pay. Well, that didn't damp down salaries. It had the absolutely opposite effect because every CEO could suddenly see all the goodies that all the other CEOs were getting and how much money everybody else was making, and they all wanted to make more or the same. And then you had these executive compensation consultants who were hired by boards and by management who would come in and say, well, our guy is worth more than these other guys, so, and here's how much they make, so we have to make more. So it became just this kind of constant ratcheting up, more goodies, more severance, more options. And it just got completely out of control. Now, when I say it's a rigged game, this is really the key point here. Who sits on boards? Other CEOs and also, you know, academics and other sort of professional board members, for lack of a better word, who are picked by the CEO and who don't want to pick off the CEO. So they have every incentive, and it's not their money. It's the shareholders' money. So they have every incentive to just pay the CEO plenty and not worry about it. And that's how you got this completely out of control situation. The comparison that I always make is to athletes who also get paid huge sums of money. The difference is those are true negotiations. And so those guys are really getting paid what the market says they're worth.
Well,
and the CEOs, you just don't have any idea whether they're getting paid what the market says they're worth because you don't know what the market actually says.
Well, the difference also, it would seem to us, with salaries and rock stars and others who get, you know, a huge amount of money, is that as soon as they're not worth that much money, they're gone. And that's our question. Pay for performance was the original name of these compensation packages, but it feels that it's been pay without the performance. What happened to any kind of checks and balances along the way to ensure that there is performance?
Well, the truth of the matter is there never really has been pay for performance. That's sort of a joke. In rare cases, maybe, but everybody talks about pay for performance, but time after time after time, they change the performance measures if the CEO is not meeting one to make sure he gets his money. And these huge severance packages that are built in, that's what Jensen's really complaining about, is the severance packages. I mean, why would you give a guy $200 million to walk away from a thing when he's already made $150 or $200 million while he was on the job? I mean, it's completely ridiculous.
Well, as we just said, Merrill Lynch's ousted CEO didn't get a severance on top of his huge stock package. Some activists see that as a good trend, but didn't CEOs drive the stock market surge? Don't they deserve the pay? We'll ask Joe about that thinking. And later, the other end of the economy, uninsured veterans. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from New York Times business columnist Joe Nocera on CEO compensation packages. Here are some numbers. Apple CEO Steve Jobs took home $646 million in cash and stock benefits last year. Ray Irani, head of Occidental Petroleum, made $321 million. And Barry Diller, a retailing mogul, made close to $300 million. Joe, the numbers might seem out of control, but you recently interviewed an executive compensation advisor. He helps companies determine how much to pay their CEOs. He said, well, look, the Dow Jones has climbed from 5,000 points in 1996 to more than 13,000 today, in large part because CEOs had these stock options and thus the incentive to raise the company's stock price. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't really believe that. I mean, I basically think they are the lucky recipients of the Dow going up. Look, there's no question that American companies have become more competitive. Is that because CEOs are getting paid so much more? I don't really think so. They would have worked just as hard for half the money. I mean, let's be honest here. Being a CEO offers all sorts of rewards in addition to financial rewards, and there would not be a lack of candidates for these jobs if the pay was less.
What about someone like Joseph Batchelder? He also negotiates these contracts for CEOs, and he wrote in 2004 that they deserve the money because, for example, an asset manager, someone who manages stocks and bonds, might make 1% of the assets, whereas CEO makes who makes $1 million a year for a $1 billion company, let's say, makes 0.01%. In other words, the companies make so much money, and that's what's left out of the equation, that this is a small percentage that the CEOs are making.
You know, the auto worker makes a fraction of what the company makes either, but, you know, people aren't saying he should get a higher percentage. It's sort of an absurd argument. You also have employee morale to think about. I mean, does it matter that you make 500 times more than the average worker?
One of your big concerns about this high pay for CEOs is that it's socially corrosive. It's a part of a class warfare. We had Paul Krugman in here recently who's very concerned about pay inequity. Your thoughts on that?
There are two sets of issues here. One is that the CEO pay has begun to really outpace even the, you know, other top executives, which breeds a kind of internal resentment. Secondly, it's hard to say a CEO should be rewarded for laying off workers, although that is a sound economic argument if it makes a company stronger in the end, and it's part of the brutality of American capitalism, which we've all come to accept. Having said that, you know, for a CEO to get $100 million, $200, $300 million when, you know, the people being laid off make $10 an hour has a let-them-eat-cake kind of feeling that leaves a really bad taste in your mouth and does make you wonder about whether, you know, this is a country that will continue to have a strong middle class and so on and so forth, or whether we really are becoming a nation of super rich and everybody else is struggling.
Stan O'Neill of Merrill Lynch, in fact, lost money for that company by gambling on the subprime mortgage market, $8 billion lost. A Boston Globe reporter wrote that, you know, homeowners who did the same thing gambled on subprime mortgages. They lost their homes. He gets, you know, $160 million in a corporate office.
That kind of rhetoric actually makes the point that I was just making, is that it just breeds resentment that the country doesn't really need.
Well, Joe Nocera, what happens? How does it change? Because it is a free market. It is a, you know, it is that kind of a democratic market. You don't want to legislate, or do you want to legislate that CEOs can't make a certain amount? Well, how does it change?
I'm not necessarily anti-government regulation, but I do think in this particular area, every time they try to regulate, it bites them in the rear.
Paul Krugman talks about norms and, you know, the idea that it just there has to be a change in thinking. Do you think there's going to be a company and a CEO, actually, a future CEO, willing to step up and say, you know what, I don't need all of that compensation? I mean, is that what it's going to take?
There actually are some now. You know, one example is Jeff Immelt. Now, he doesn't make peanuts. He makes millions of dollars. He's the chief executive of General Electric, and he followed a legendary greedhead, Jack Welch, Boston boy, I might add. And Immelt is on record as saying, I don't ever want my salary to be an issue for this company. And so it is not unheard of for a CEO to say, you know, I don't want to make more than X because it's not right and it's corrosive for my employees and, you know, there has to be some sense of shared sacrifice. One of the problems is that the country itself doesn't have a sense of shared sacrifice. It's lost that. And CEO pay is just kind of an example of that. Basically, they're saying, I want mine. I don't really care what happens to you.
It's funny you say that, Joe, because we were thinking, well, there are a lot of stockholders that are starting to make noise and stockholder groups that are, you know, have been protesting this. But you'd think that these CEOs, failed CEOs in particular, might have been thrown overboard long ago by stockholders. But then you realize how much, you know, stocks have gone up across the board. And as you say, maybe people are less willing to get angry when, in fact, their stocks are inching up a little bit.
What's really happening now is that shareholder activists have done a pretty good job of agitating to get rid of underperforming CEOs. Now, they haven't been able to detach the severance packages because these guys have contracts, but they've been able to say, this guy's been underperforming for 5 years, get rid of him, get somebody else. And that's kind of happened.
Well, when you talk about the contracts, I mean, I hate to bring it up because I do far too often mention our beloved hometown Red Sox, and people out of the area, I'm sure, are sick of it. But you're right that, you know, the other problem is who negotiates those contracts in the first place. And you say these companies need, you know, well, someone like Theo Epstein of the Boston Red Sox to negotiate more fiercely.
And I think that's the next step. I think what you're going to see next, I think you're going to see the same group of shareholder activists begin to agitate on the issue of pay itself. as opposed to just pure underperformance. There are some things the SEC could do that would allow shareholders to have a greater voice in executive pay. And so far, the SEC has been reluctant to take those steps. But it's very easy to envision a Democratic administration with a Democratic SEC commissioner and the Democrats having a 3-2 vote over the Republicans in the SEC. You could definitely see some moves that would give shareholders a lot more say and a lot more power in executive pay. And then I think we would really see what the market says CEOs should make.
New York Times business columnist Joe Nocera speaking to us about the huge climb in executive pay. Joe, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, Hillary Clinton's chief strategist Mark Penn, he says one out of four Republican women might defect to the Democratic ticket with a woman on it. Is that wishful thinking? And still ahead today, the story of the judge who regretted sending people to their death at the Salem witch trials of 1692. Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
I do understand that, though it's an honor, this is not an honorary position, and there is a lot of work to be done.
That's retired Army General James Peak, President Bush's nominee to head the Department of Veterans Affairs. If confirmed by the Senate, the decorated Vietnam vet would be the first doctor and first general to serve as secretary of the government's second-largest agency. Peak's nomination comes as the administration and Congress struggle to revamp the VA, which was so criticized for not providing adequate medical treatment or disability benefits to millions of veterans. That point was not lost on Peak during his introduction yesterday at the White House.
The disability system is largely a 1945 product, 1945 processes around a 1945 family unit. About everybody that has studied it recently said it is time to do some revisions.
But at his confirmation hearings, Peak, who was the Army Surgeon General from 2000 to 2004, will likely be asked if he's partly responsible for shoddy outpatient treatment at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, Dr. Steffi Woolhandler will probably be monitoring those hearings. She teaches at Harvard Medical School. She's a practicing physician at Cambridge Hospital. And she's just published a study on uninsured veterans that shows nearly 2 million of them lack health insurance and have no access to care at VA facilities. She joins us now in the studio. And Dr. Woolhandler, what would you want to hear General Peak say?
I want him to say that all veterans, regardless of income, will have access to the VA. Since early 2003, middle-income veterans have been banned from enrolling for VA medical care. That's part of the reason why we now have nearly 2 million veterans, many of them combat veterans, who have no access to VA health care.
Well, you know, you are someone that works with patients seeking care at Cambridge Hospital, and you were surprised to hear what had happened. Explain to us again why so many patients started coming into you, so many veterans, who had no insurance.
Well, in the late 90s, all veterans, regardless of income, could go to the VA, which was kind of a good deal because the quality's been improving in the VA and is, in fact, higher than the average quality in the civilian sector, according to the scientific studies. But in the 90s, people could go. In mid-2002, the Department of Veteran Affairs stopped marketing to middle-income vets. And then in early 2003, they said from now on, no middle-income veterans can get care at the VA, except, of course, for service-connected problems. And they consider middle income anyone earning more than about $30,000 a year.
Right.
So that most working age vets, and most of them are in fact in the workforce, will be earning too much money to qualify for VA care. And yet many of them earn too little money to go out and buy private insurance. So they're just caught in the middle.
Right. And there's a reported waiting list of over 300,000. Can we say there's a direct line between this, you know, ban on the I wouldn't even say middle income. I would say low middle income vets getting insurance and the huge numbers suddenly requesting it because of the war in Iraq?
Well, there certainly is a relationship between the ban and the rise in the number of uninsured mm-hmm. people. So the rise in the number of uninsured veterans between 2000 and 2004 is quite significant, 300,000.
Give us some of the numbers on the vets. What did you mm-hmm. find? How many are uninsured?
Well, 1.8 million are uninsured. Typical uninsured veteran is a man in his late 40s. He's worked within the past year. In addition, there's about 3.8 million members of veterans' households, family members of veterans who have no insurance. Added together, veterans and their family members make up More than 12% of all uninsured people in this country, one out of every eight uninsured people is a veteran or a member of a veteran's family.
When you also say that, in general, veterans fare better than the overall population when it comes to getting health insurance, so what's the particular concern that these veterans be helped?
Well, veterans fare a little better because of the VA. They have an additional safety net, but they don't fare very well. Among non-elderly veterans, one out of eight, 12.7%, one out of eight non-elderly veterans has no health insurance, no access to the VA. So it may be a little bit better than other people, but it's certainly not good enough. You know, I think everybody deserves health care, but particularly when we talk about veterans, their sacrifice reminds us that in a society we're supposed to serve and protect each other, and we're not serving and protecting these veterans, and we're certainly not serving and protecting the other 45 million uninsured people.
Well, let's get some of the, you know, your critics in here. Beside your position at Harvard Medical School, you're also a founder of the group Physicians for a National Health Program. You've been very outspoken about wanting that, and some of your critics, including Florida Republican Congressman Cliff Stearns, say, you know, maybe you skewed the result of your study because you have another objective, which is national health care.
I have an objective, which is universal, nonprofit national health care, but the study is a scientific study using Census Bureau data. It was extensively peer-reviewed by the American Journal of Public Health before publication. Those are the numbers. That's the scientific standard, is 2 million uninsured vets.
And what about the criticism that, you know, this is just a sign of the times, we can't afford free insurance for vets who don't have the most severe problems? Indiana Congressman Steve Beyer says the VA should just focus on the core constituency, the indigent, those with catastrophic disabilities. And, you know, he appreciates the service of veterans, but why should the government provide, you know, essentially what's free health care for life to someone who's served as little as a year or two?
Well, everyone deserves good health care, and the VA, with a modest increase in their budget, could cover all veterans. So this is not really about money. It's about whether we have a commitment to provide universal health care.
I'm wondering, too, do these veterans that you're seeing, again, they're not at the VA with a catastrophic problem, but they may be coming to a local hospital. Are their problems negligible? What are their problems?
Okay. Well, diabetes, mild diabetes or hypertension, is a negligible problem unless you fail to take care of it. And that's what's happening. People are not taking care of their diabetes, not taking care of their high blood pressure because they can't afford health care. And then they're showing up with a stroke, with kidney failure, with an amputation, with much more serious and costly problems in the long run. So people do need this care in order to live long, healthy lives. And by denying people care for hypertension and diabetes, you're just causing them to die younger and have more problems in the future.
Are people surprised? Because I think there's the perception that, oh, well, one of the things that happens when you get in the service is that you get free health care or free insurance. I mean, people think you're nodding yes.
Well, certainly many of the soldiers themselves think that once they enroll in the VA, they're going to get these tremendous benefits and are surprised when they get home and find that they can't get access to even veterans' health care.
I'm wondering, do you ever see veterans who have to make a choice, you know, a $30,000 a year job is going to cut me off of health insurance?
I haven't known people to make that explicit decision, but I do know that when people get so sick that they lose their job, their diabetes gets out of control, their high blood pressure gets out of control, then their income will fall and they'll get VA care. But that's, of course, rather penny wise and pound foolish to structure things that way.
Steffi Woolhander, Harvard Medical School professor and practicing physician at Cambridge Hospital. Her study on uninsured veterans appears in the December issue of the American Journal of Public Health. You can go to our website to see more, here-now.org. Dr. Woolhandler, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And in about 5 minutes, the Salem witch trials. It's really kind of amazing. On this day, so many Americans dress up like witches. In 1692, we were hanging them. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, in a huge shift for the military, problems that were once whispered about are now on the pages of the Fort Campbell Courier at the Fort Campbell, Kentucky military base in an advice column written by Vicki Johnson, a social worker and wife of a career soldier. "Dear Miss Vicki" is how the letters start, and they give insight into the issues confronting military families enduring long deployments in an unpopular war. They also reveal possible new thinking on the part of the military. Vicki Johnson's column has become so popular that now Military Spouse magazine has asked her to write one, and other base newspapers are considering their own advice columns. Well, joining us now is Ms. Vicki Johnson. In addition to being a social worker and a military wife, she's also the mother of three and a cancer survivor. Welcome. It's a huge shift for the military. Problems that were once whispered about are now on the front page of the Fort Campbell Courier, the newspaper of record on the Kentucky military base, in an advice column written by Vicki Johnson, a social worker and wife of a career soldier. "Dear Ms. Vicki" is how the letters start. They come from soldiers, spouses, children, and they give insight into the issues confronting military families enduring long deployments and an unpopular war. They also reveal possible new thinking on the part of the military. Vicki Johnson's column has become so popular that now Military Spouse magazine has asked her to write one, and other base newspapers are considering their own advice columns. Well, joining us on the line now is Ms. Vicki Johnson. In addition to being a social worker in military circles, a military wife, she's also the mother of three and a cancer survivor. Vicki, welcome.
Hey, how are you doing, Robin?
I'm good. Can you give us just a laundry list of some of the things people write you about?
Wow, you know, Robin, I get letters about marriage and infidelity, just couples communication, child rearing, mothers writing in wanting to know how can I support my son or my daughter who's in the military. A lot of PTSD questions, you know, how to help my soldier who's returned.
With post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you get emails from the front lines as well?
I sure do. You know what, Robin? I started writing it when I was at Fort Campbell, like you said. After about a week of the column being in the Fort Campbell Courier, I started getting letters from in my own personal mailbox, for example. If I was out shopping at the stores, I would get letters left on my car windshield.
Well, I understand, too, that part of the reason that this started is that as a social worker in military circles there on the base, you were getting late-night calls from, you know, top-ranking military people who needed to talk about some of these things.
Mm-hmm, sure did.
Well, let's give a sense of what you tell them. For instance, you received one letter signed, "Marriage is over, but I'm happy now." This woman said that her husband was deployed so many times and had put his career, in her mind, ahead of his family.
Yeah.
So she decided to have an affair, and she was asking your advice on whether or not to tell him while he's in Iraq that she wants a divorce. You had some pretty tough language for her.
Yeah, I did.
You told her to get real.
Yeah, get real about this. Now, what would that do to him, to the man who wants him to be at his best, to his left and to his right? I just thought that would be very, very sabotaging.
Well, you know, that raises the question. I mean, perhaps this woman was in dire, emotional straits and needed to come clean, be honest,
okay,
for her own emotion.
Mm-hmm.
So someone would say, well, you know, are you speaking for the military, you know, or are you speaking, you know, as someone representing two people in a marriage?
You know, I'm not working for Department of Defense in any way. I just want to tell people the right thing to do, Robin. And in my mind, I just, okay, you're having an affair. She's an adult. She's tired. She's had it. I got it. Her question to me was, should I send him a Dear John letter? The answer's no.
And it's getting quite a debate going on the base. We know the base leaders were really reluctant at first, but there seems to have been a sea change. Why? What are they seeing?
You know, I think that it has helped. You know, Robin, we really progressed specifically when it comes to mental health services in our country. And yes, we are looking at ways to provide more mental health services to our military service members, which is a good thing. But I credit that because people are coming forth talking about the problems.
You got a letter from a soldier who said he's one snap away from losing it after two deployments. He doesn't want to go and get help because he's afraid he'll lose his clearance,
mm-hmm,
and his bosses won't trust him anymore. And you were very honest. You said you're not sure if it wouldn't affect his career.
If somebody's a pilot or, you know, you're flying planes or helicopters, surely you're not going to continue to fly if you have substance or alcohol abuse problem.
Yeah.
That's for your good and for everybody else's good. But now regarding the clearances, no, I'm not sure how that would affect it if you came for it.
Yeah. Well, Vicki Johnson, again, we mentioned you had your own experiences. Your husband was on a two-week break from Iraq when you told him that you had cancer. You told him. You didn't keep it from him in that case.
No, I didn't. And so he needed to know, but I wanted him to know that I was going to be okay.
Yeah. Vicki Johnson writes the Dear Ms. Vicki column in the Fort Campbell Courier and now Military Spouse magazine as well. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you so much, Robin. It was nice meeting you.
It's Here and Now. How lucky for us. Eve LaPlante is a great writer, and she has fascinating ancestors to write about. In American Jezebel, Eve told the story of her 11th great-grandmother, Anne Hutchinson, who was convicted of heresy and banished from the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1637. She later co-founded a colony in Rhode Island. Now, just in time for Halloween, comes Eve's new book, Salem Witch Judge, The Life and Repentance of Samuel Sewell. It's about her 6th great-grandfather. Sewell was the only judge to apologize for condemning 20 people to death during the infamous witch trials of 1692. 19 were hanged. One was pressed to death under a door laden with dirt and debris. His atonement led Sewell to speak out against slavery, the harsh treatment of Native Americans, and the inequality of women. His tomb is near Paul Revere's in the old Granary Burial Ground here in downtown Boston. That's where Here Now's Alex Ashlock met up with Eve LaPlante to talk family history.
When I was a small child, I used to go out to the tip of Cape Cod to visit my great-aunt Charlotte, who died in 1980. She was a very colorful figure. She was a Victorian spinster. She wore stockings and a dress even to the beach. And she would regale me with tales of all of our famous and infamous ancestors. Her favorite ancestor was the Salem witch judge. She would tell me what a great man he was, and he loved his children. He was a great lover of music.
He loved to sing.
He loved to sing. He loved to sing the Psalms, I now know. And it didn't quite square with a Salem witch judge, what I knew as a child of that, which seemed quite evil. And then the most colorful thing she told me was after he realized he'd made this terrible mistake at Salem in 1692, he put on a coarse sackcloth for the rest of his life, which rubbed against his skin to remind him of his sin, and he was buried in it. This is basically the story I had in my mind until I was about 40 years old and I started to go back and try to understand why my Aunt Charlotte had loved this man and what might be appealing about him.
Was there a particular case or a particular execution that led him to that moment of repentance?
Of the 20 executions that the court ordered, 14 women and 6 men, 2 of the men were actually Sewell's friends and peers. One was John Alden Jr., who actually escaped the Boston jail and lived. But the other was the Reverend George Burroughs. He had been in the class of 1670 at Harvard. He was a friend of Sewell's, who was in the class of 1671. They were buddies. And he was pulled down from Maine by the court, and he was questioned, and he was convicted, and he was hanged in August of 1692. And as he was about to die on the gallows, the Reverend George Burroughs recited the Lord's Prayer, and the crowd, believing that a witch, or a wizard in this case, could not correctly pray, assumed that he would make a mistake, and he recited it flawlessly. So the crowd started to buzz, and Cotton Mather had to quiet them and shout, "The devil may appear among us as an angel of light." The same day, Sewell wrote in his diary, quote, "This day George Burroughs, John Willard, John Proctor, Martha Carrier, and George Jacobs were executed at Salem. They all said they were innocent." Then, referring to a private conversation with Increase Mather, Samuel reassured himself, "Mr. Mather says they died by a righteous sentence." But Samuel was sorry to have heard that Mr. Burroughs, by his speech, prayer, and protestation of his innocence, did much move unthinking persons. And then in the margins, he added the words, "doleful witchcraft."
There's another scene in the book and in Samuel Sewell's life that takes place right here at the tomb. And this is after the death of one of his daughters. So many of his children died.
Yes, this is 4 years after the Salem witch hunt. It's late December of 1696. His little 2-year-old Sarah is sick, as many of his babies were, with convulsions. And he asked the minister to come pray with his daughter. and there was public prayer. The little girl went to bed with Samuel and his wife Hannah that evening, and a nurse ministered to her through the night. At dawn the next morning, while Samuel Sewell and his wife were sleeping, Sarah gave up the ghost in the nurse's arms. "Dear little Sarah dies," Samuel reported. Thinking of his own inattention, he added, "I thought of Christ's words in the Garden of Gethsemane to Peter and his other disciples. Could you not watch with me 1 hour?" Then the family prays together. His son, Sam Jr., reads the Gospel of Matthew, the 7th verse. Samuel is overcome with remorse because he has condemned the guiltless. This verse, he wrote, did awfully bring to mind the Salem tragedy. On Christmas, which the Puritans did not observe, at the burial, the family gathered, and then afterwards they all went home. Samuel then goes back alone to this tomb where we're standing now. Alone, he stands in the tomb meditating on death, where he's entertained with a view of and conversation with the coffins of, he says, my dead father Hull, mother Hull, cousin Quincy, and my 6 children. And at this point in his life, he's just about to make his public repentance for Salem.
And so 2 weeks later, he does repent, and there's this extraordinary scene which you write about in the book, and also there's a mural of in the Massachusetts State House near where we are, where he repents and the minister reads his repentance. Just tell me a little bit about that event.
It was January 14th, 1697. It was bitterly cold, and it was a fast day because they were feeling that things were not going well in the colony. They're gathered at the church, and the Reverend Samuel Willard read out for the congregation Samuel Sewall's note. It's actually strange because it's in the third person. It said, Samuel Sewall is, upon many accounts, more concerned than any he knows of, a reference to the other Salem witch judges and perhaps some other leading men. And he desires to take the blame and shame of it, that is, the Salem witch hunt, asking pardon of men and desiring prayers that God would pardon that sin and all other of his sins. He's doing something that no one else involved in that event in 1692 had done, and his chief judge, William Stoughton, still thought was wrong and felt that no one should take the blame.
So many years later, what do you think this story tells us today? Why does it resonate with you?
I think it's very compelling to see someone who's high up, who makes a mistake, and rather than falling, which is sort of classic tragedy, turns and becomes a better person. But I think right now we have a sense of perhaps similar to what the Puritans felt, that there's sin or wrongdoing in our world, and we may have the power to change it, but we also have to have the kind of change of heart that Samuel Sewall had. I think powerful people don't tend to do what he did, and that makes him stand out. And he did it at some risk to himself. I mean, the story of Salem now is really a story of the witches being heroic, and there's no question about that. In fact, they're not witches. The so-called witches, those who were hanged, were the only ones who would not confess that they were allied with Satan. So it was the people who said, I'm allied with Satan, who went home. So the so-called witches are those noble souls who wouldn't say that. And they're already heroic, but this is an interesting story, sort of turning the history over and then saying, isn't it ironic that this man who's a Salem witch judge wrote an early treatise calling for the right of women, which was completely ignored and has been out of print since 1724. It's in the back of my book. I think it's a very compelling story. He's also turns out to be a pretty lovable guy. After all, my Aunt Charlotte was right.
That's Eve LaPlante, author of Salem Witch Judge, The Life and Repentance of Samuel Sewall. She spoke with Here Now's Alex Ashlock. For more, including Eve reading from one of Samuel Sewall's essays, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a safe Halloween and join us again here and now.
Thank you. funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.